Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.
Can now, so that you can move over to Joe while he's available.
Forgive me for rambling on
that's
so
okay.
much. I wanted to get your...
I'm here.
Yeah.
Most of the time, Joe is the one that's much busier than I am.
I found that out.
Busy.
Yeah.
In line, but he's even more impossible to get a hold of. So if you can get even 20 minutes, get
Alex,
started
Alex,
here.
Alex, where are you from originally?
New York City. Really, I started in this business in New York City with an outfit called Van Buren at the time. They would do.
Can I ask you first, who are your parents, and did you have a kind of a happy background at all, or was it a rough background?
Well, let's put it this way. I was very poor.
Uh-huh.
I was brought up, I reached my early manhood during the period of a depression. Jobs were hard to get. And I worked in a bakery for a while. I had to quit school, help support my mother. It was like you, mother and father split, and
yes.
I was taking care of my mother. And through a very peculiar set of circumstances, I found myself in this business, and I loved it.
Had you been just a good doodler? And
I always won the art medals in school, mm-hmm. and so forth, and one of my posters was chosen by the SPCA to be the poster of the year at that particular time, but it never occurred to me to draw for my living, and I always wanted to be a pilot of all things. And I am now.
Hmm.
And a mutual friend introduced me to animation, had a friend work in an animation studio, knew I could draw, and said, come, we'll see this friend of mine.
And you had not really had
a none whatsoever.
Training.
Never went to an art school or anything. Actually, this gentleman that got me into animation was a foreigner, born person, Hungarian, and he didn't know how to describe animation. It's kind of cute. He said, you get your pictures and we go see my friend. He makes jumping pictures there. And I didn't know what he was talking about. So I brought some of my drawings, the jumping pictures. This is his description of animation. He didn't know how to say it. Anyway, I was just overwhelmed with the idea of doing cartoons, and I started at the very bottom and have been in this business ever since.
Van Buren?
Van Buren, a now defunct company for many, many years.
Did you mention any of the characters?
They used an original Tom and Jerry, believe it or not, the title, which was nothing like
yes.
the Tom and Jerry that Joe and Bill made later for MGM. Entirely different, yeah. Just a name. They did a thing called Cubby Bear, and some of those rather early in the 30s, 40s, 30s, I guess, would be cartoons. I can't remember the names of the others, just ad-lib. There was no particular series. Aesop Fables, that's right. They did a lot of Aesop Fables.
Now,
that's
how
far back
they
go.
Continue with that?
I was with them for possibly 5 years and then decided to come out to California. My first job I got was with Disney as an animator.
In California and started making the rounds.
Well, I already had contacted somebody at Disney, so I had a job all set here, and I worked there for about 3 months and met Walter Lantz, who decided to try something new called storyboarding.
What were you doing for Disney?
Animation. Just animating. Yeah. Actually, I was working on Snow White at the time. That's how far back it goes. And Walter Lantz asked me to come over and illustrate stories a la storyboard, and that's how I started with him. Well, I did that for possibly 6 to 8 months, and then he asked me to direct some of the pictures. And I was directing for him, with him, for a long, long time. Until I went into service for 3 years, came back, went back to Walter Lantz for a while. Then I came over to Hanna-Barbera about 17 years ago, I guess, 18 years, something like that.
How did
been
that
a long time.
How did that transition evolve from Walter Lantz?
I knew Joe Barbera back in New York. We worked together at Van Buren. We've always been friends. And we've always got along pretty well. He admired me, I admire him, and so forth. And when he started, the idea of what he was doing, cartoons for TV, appealed to me. Mm-hmm. And I had a talk with him, and I decided to come along with Joe, and I've been here ever since, with rare exception. I've gone out and done a few other things here and there, but mostly I've stayed with Hanna-Barbera.
I've talked to so many animators that have jumped around from countless studios, and it sounds like you've been pretty stable.
Mostly stable, yeah. I mean, here and there I've gone away left Hanna-Barbera for a few months, and possibly once for a year. I don't think I ever left that long, though, but I've been pretty stable with Hanna-Barbera.
Can you talk briefly about the different companies and the different, was there a different kind of an atmosphere at different companies? I understand that Walter Lantz was kind of a fun guy to work for.
He is.
Act together and plan for his workers.
Walter Lantz is a very fine, fine man. Fine gentleman. I have nothing but the best to say for him. He's a warm human being, an excellent creator of cartoons. He had the knack of taking suggestions from his workers. The biggest thing I found for moving from Walter Lantz, where I did theatrical cartoons, to Hanna-Barbera, where we did television cartoons, was I'd have like six weeks to make a little 7-minute short, which meant it was just easy going and so on and so forth. I'd come over to Hanna-Barbera and we had to turn out a half-hour picture a week. And all of a sudden everything was in a big hurry and I had to adjust myself entirely. And this is funny, after so many years of this kind of a schedule, I find it creeps into my own personal life. Everything I do in a hurry. I rest in a hurry. I play in a hurry, and so forth. I've got to catch myself.
Yeah, you got to budget your time almost.
Must remember that this is not anything that has to be done.
That's interesting. Yeah.
I think everybody goes through a thing like that here. It's a odd thing, but we all have to do that.
Well, this is the largest cartoon company in the world.
That's right.
I guess people have a right to run around in holes with their heads cut off like chickens. When I looked at, when I interviewed Bill Hanna, I saw their schedules, you know, all the different shows, and it was just amazing that they were doing that much of children. Does that bother you at all that Hanna-Barbera does have some form of kind of a monopoly? I mean, when you turn on Saturday morning television, you see things from Filmation that you can't hardly tell the difference between Filmation and Hanna-Barbera, for instance.
That's right. We like to feel, and I think I'm being a little unjust on this, but we like to feel that we started it. Hanna-Barbera started the styling of Saturday morning shows, which is true, we did.
Yes.
Other studios stepped in later, like Filmation, the Patty Freeling, and found the method we used to be the most practical, the only way to do a Saturday morning show on a kind of a budget we had at the time. So they were almost forced to imitate us. And in imitation, naturally, their stuff looks similar to ours, and so forth. We try to stay a step ahead by a diversification in styling and so forth, which we've been pretty successful at. Filmation, on the other hand, has gone off now into their own style and doing things as they grow. Patty Freeling has his own style.
Yeah, I know. I can tell now because I look for it. I'm constantly looking at it to where I can begin to recognize the differences right away. Besides knowing what the name of the cartoon is, flipping through the channel, that must be Hanna-Barbera.
Yeah.
Because I hear certain sound effects, I hear certain things that give it away. But I think that the children can't tell that difference. for some reason. I don't think they... I think it all kind of runs together.
Yeah, I doubt it. I don't think...
So it must be difficult to come up with fresh ideas.
Absolutely.
All the time
and there's such a big demand every year. We have several hours of worth of work to do, and each one has to be a little different than the others, and there's a constant commotion of creativity here, always thinking ahead, what'll we do next year and the year after that, and so on and so forth with ideas, because for a dozen ideas we might come up with, a dozen may be shot down.
That's right. Now, I want to get into that right now. At Walter Lantz, you had much more creative control. You had much more creative freedom because you didn't have these networks on your back.
That's right.
You were creating for the theater.
I was creating for the theater there.
But still, I noticed that the Woody Woodpeckers, as we talk about the change in characters, you know, Woody was a pretty nasty little Woody Woodpecker at the beginning. I mean, he was crazy too.
His cuckoo.
He'd go around baseball parks and jump on people's heads and I noticed he changed without the pressure of the networks.
No, that's right.
Was that something just to kind of go along with the times? How did that all...
Well, I think that happened because we wanted to give Woody a more lovable character instead of just a zany guy that went around making a lot of trouble. At first, we didn't realize the potential of Woody's popularity. And as we became aware of it, we decided to give him a personality to make him a lovable character, which we did, fully realizing that picture after picture of him just going around raising havoc with everybody would soon become dull. By giving him a character and a lovable character, he grew in popularity. So
personally,
it was,
I love that craziness. That was the part I waited for as a kid.
That was good, of course. But then inane.
Can you recall any of those really zany things that Woody did? I mean, I'm talking about almost surrealistic kind of moves that he would do, like Tex Avery style.
We did a lot of that. It's difficult for me to recall anything particular. You just mentioned somewhere he would peck at somebody's head and bend his beak and then pull it out straight again and so forth. He was quite a rascal.
Did you go to the theaters at that time? Did you feel your audience response?
Yes, of course. Yeah, I would go to a movie to see what the people seemed to laugh at. We would do that constantly to be a better judge of what kind of gags we
put in. And
you
probably get laughs that you didn't expect.
A lot of times they would not laugh at something I thought for sure they wouldn't, and they'd
be a
giggle.
Some kind of inside joke, perhaps. Yeah.
Or there'd be a giggle or something. So that's the way we learned how to serve the public in a thing, by just having these so-called previews, if you will.
I noticed with the Woody Woodpecker, it comes out right at the beginning, and I'm sure at times that would get a applause response immediately from the audience.
Woody, it's amazing. He did catch on, and as soon as the title came out of Woody Woodpecker, we would hear a lot of applause.
Or the universal sign.
That was very... very encouraging to us, and that you made us feel very gratified.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you work with Mel Blanc for a while?
Yeah.
And was it Warner Brothers? I haven't interviewed him yet, but was it Warner Brothers that offered him a nice deal?
Yes, Warner Brothers. He actually started with Warner Brothers doing a lot of characters before we came on with Woody Woodpecker.
I see.
And then we got him to do Woody Woodpecker, and it became an alive character. And then along the line, for reasons unknown to me even yet, he stopped doing Woody Woodpecker, and Walt's wife, Grace Stafford, who's an actress, did an excellent imitation of what
almost
he did.
Almost without having to speed the thing up so much. Yeah.
So we started using her for many, many years, and she was very good at it.
Now, I know through interviewing Dawes, by the way, Dawes is probably the man I've interviewed for the longest length of time. I think I have Dawes on tape for 12 hours. We got to be very good friends. I like Dawes. But I know he's done so much work for Walter Lantz, and there's been a lot of these cartoons that I think most people hear Walter Lantz, they think right away Woody Woodpecker,
yeah.
But he's done so much more than that. A lot of one-time kind of cartoons.
Right.
Can you tell me about some of your favorites of things that most people don't think of right away?
We did during the war years, before I got in the service, we did a bunch of musical cartoons using popular songs. We were working with Universal then, and the Andrews sisters were there too. Mm-hmm. And we had a deal with Universal to use a lot of their songs, like Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy, mm-hmm. for example, which was very popular
yes.
at the time. We turned it in the song itself into a little cartoon. As a matter of fact, it went very well. We got kinds of recognition on it, and we didn't win an Oscar, but it was nominated for one.
Mm-hmm.
And they were fun, these little musical things we did, borrowing popular ditties from Universal movies and making these cartoons. I'm trying to remember the name
of
it. Some
kind of
it was kind of good. Yeah, call them something symphonies, and I'll be damned if I can remember. I remember Silly Symphonies.
Yeah.
It was Disney, but these were, we call them something else. But they were kind of fun. Then we did one called Homer Pigeon. It was a little pigeon that was a carrier pigeon. And that was kind of a cute cartoon. Never got as popular as Woody Woodpecker, of course, but it was kind of fun. And
Andy Pandas,
which were sort of a sweet little cartoon, and apparently caught on with kids, but not so much adults, I feel. I don't think it did. But we did quite a few of them, come to think of it.
When were Woody's kids introduced?
Good question. After about doing 6 or 7 years of cartoons, we decided to add a family there, and we got his nephews, I believe they were.
Similar to Popeye's nephews.
Yeah, similar, yeah. So that way we didn't have married,
yes.
so on and so
has
forth.
These kids.
So we introduced the kids. It's a natural evolution
Nuthead,
of anything.
Walter,
yeah.
June Frey did the
yes. It's a natural evolution of any character. Pretty soon you have to broaden out and bring in other characters because you run out of singular plots with only this one person. So if he has a couple of nephews, it opens up a whole area of opportunities to write stuff, including nephews or whatever the thing may be.
Can we switch now to Hanna-Barbera
yeah.
for a moment? When Hanna-Barbera came out with the early Rough and Ready's and
mm-hmm.
Huckleberry Hounds, and there was a lot of people, because they were so spoiled by these
yeah.
cartoons that the theater had, would call the things that Hanna-Barbera were doing cheap garbage,
yeah.
Selling out. You know,
mm-hmm.
things like this were set. What did you say to your fellow animators that were continuing at the other studios?
Well, we were looked on as traitors, if you will.
Yes.
You know, they despised what we were doing. But we realized there was a whole area of output in television, and we knew that eventually the theatricals, because at MGM they've already stopped doing their very, very popular program because they were becoming too expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So we were the first one in television. We overcame this
limit. Well, Crusader Rabbit, I think, was the first one that
probably
really
yes.
made it.
Yes, it was, right. Yeah. But then I'm talking, as far as Hanna-Barbera is concerned, by writing some very clever stories and clever dialogue, we felt we could overcome the lack of movement and characters
master,
and so
Dawes,
forth.
Yeah.
Dawes.
Did it perfect.
And we had some excellent writers, and it proved to be very successful. Now, all those people who made sarcastic remarks to us are all working for us.
That's right.
So
they finally,
we
finally come
to realize that it had to be.
People across the street.
Yeah.
And pick them up from everywhere.
We wrote some very, very funny things. We also had a lot of liberties to do whatever we want because we worked, in those days, we worked directly with the buyer, and they were
Kellogg's.
Happy, Kellogg's, for example, they were happy with anything we did. Gradually, the networks became the buyers and then in turn sold or serviced their clients. And gradually, the networks start dictating certain things because of pressures by PTA groups and so on and so forth, the violence bit, which makes it more and more difficult to make the kind of cartoons we made before.
Well, now, the Yogi Bears and the Huckleberry Hounds and the Quick Draw McGraws were never really too violent, were they?
No. But just to pick up an example, he would draw a gun, shoot a guy, the guy would fall over, and he'd go on his way, and then the guy would get up. It was always, you always realized that he didn't kill anybody or anything like that. But today we're not even allowed to, if we can show a gun, it's got to stay in the holster. We're not allowed to pull it out or point it, or God forbid we should shoot it at somebody. We're not allowed to do things like that.
Can you tell me some of the other things that you know you should steer away from?
Anything, basically the formula is this: anything that a kid can mimic and maybe hurt somebody, like hit someone with a club, a barrel stave, or anything like that.
Popeye, for instance, can't.
Popeye cannot
flip off a table acrobatically, because the child might try it.
Well, yeah, unless it's something that the child has no access to.
Yeah,
he can't do. But we don't have any contact violence. He's not allowed to punch Bluto or get into fist fights with Bluto like they used to. Popeye will set up some kind of a scheme where Bluto bangs into a wall himself rather than letting Popeye push him into a wall.
You know, I asked Bill Hannah a question about Popeye. I said, Popeye was one of the biggest ones that was accused of having so many problems,
mm-hmm.
you know, for groups like PTA. I mean, he did so many bad things. It's surprising that after all that Hanna-Barbera would want to bring it back. I said, how did it come to be that Popeye was brought back? And his answer was, well, we bought the rights to it, and we thought we would do it, and we did it.
Yeah.
I mean, is it really that simple?
Just about. The PTA groups determine what the kids should watch. They never ask the kids. Our Popeyes are now one of the most popular shows on the air this season.
Mm-hmm.
We've avoided the contact violence to appease the various groups. And I can understand these groups. I can understand their concern with their children. But on the other hand, I, a lot of other people were raised with cartoons that were supposedly violent. And we didn't exactly turn out bad, violent people. We understood this to be fantasy.
Yes.
Just like you read a comic book or a cartoon script, you take it for granted that it's just fantasy. And we don't understand the attitude of these people when most of them will allow a child criticize a cartoon that's on the air and then let the kid turn over to some violent live-action program, shootouts and gangsters and so forth. And we don't understand why they don't control it instead of trying us to get us.
Sex shows that come on.
Kids watch them just like adults do.
Kids go to bed at a later hour than
absolutely.
They used to.
And to us, it's a big farce. This is ridiculous. We feel a lot of these groups are just trying to make a lot of noise for themselves and become
popular.
That's
what I can't understand is that when there's so many guidelines, like she was literally changing the Popeye script in her office at CBS, and I kind of went, well, gosh, and then how come they don't make a big stink about, they even have names for it now. What do they call them, TNA or what is it?
Yeah.
You know? They even got
program
names for
practices
it. Yeah.
And so
in fact, I saw, what is it, recently in TV Guide or something, they call it kids porno or something.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting, you know, that
in a situation like that you observe with Faith, the comments she makes, and this goes with every network, are their own feelings about a particular board or script and so forth. Now they'll come back to me and she says, I don't understand why this is that. I'd like this to be changed to here. Now I'm servicing the CBS program people, so I'll say, okay, you want the pants longer, I'll make the pants longer or shorter. Unless I feel that I'm doing something disparaging to my product. If I don't agree with her, I will
trying to
work it out with her by coming up with a proper solution. Most of the time she will agree with me and sometimes she won't, and we work it out though, and so forth.
Now I haven't interviewed Art Scott yet, so I will print probably the final outcome and I'll probably hear what he had to say about it. But I understand that he had a little bit too much pressure and from the network.
He had
no
more pressure than any of us do. But Art resents the dictating from the networks more
freedom.
Than us.
He's had enough freedom to work.
And he feels that it's not fair for them to tell us how to do. All of us have done some great, great cartoons. We have great backgrounds. And now suddenly these people come in telling us how to make cartoons, what's funny and what's not. Mm-hmm. He resents it.
Yes.
We all resent it, but we figure, what are we going to do? We can't do anything about it.
Do you think things are going to change soon?
No.
No, I think so.
I
this is the way
so.
It is now.
We have to live with it, yeah. We, all of us, are trying to take a little firmer attitude by politely arguing with the network instead of just accepting their dictums and doing it. We're going to resist if we feel strong about it. But never to a point where we'll say, well, it's either my way or no way. Naturally, we're not going to do that.
Yeah.
We don't want to be out
of
work.
But you can't pull your top off at them.
No, of course not. They're the buyers.
That's right.
You know, the customer is always right.
Mm-hmm.
So, but to protect our own professional integrity where we feel they maybe are making a bad choice, we will try to argue with them. And
something
we have.
That confused me in her office was that I asked about certain shows and she says, oh, well, that wasn't on our network last year. That was on another network. And I go, well, wait a minute. How does that work? And she explained the whole thing to me, how they'll put something on a shelf for a while and another network will buy it and rerun the same things that were shown before, but and call it something new.
Yeah.
The new adventures of
the new.
They have a new announcer.
Yeah.
Or
so forth. That's right. They do that.
How does that make you feel? Does that bother you at
all? Not at all.
Do you think that's a bit of a sellout?
Not really. It doesn't really bother me because.
But I mean, it's strange though that if the new adventures of Tarzan or something that's may having a better rating on the other network, and you're up against, Hanna-Barbera's up against their own
something
thing.
I made, yeah. Well, we find this constantly anyway.
Yeah.
We do so much.
So much.
You can go across several given hours, like 9 a.m., and you'll find that each network is running one of our products that we're making for them. And then it becomes embarrassing because they all want good ratings. There's only going to be one good one. And we have to apologize to the other two. But as long as we give them the numbers that they like, we're all right.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit of, I really find it fascinating about how things got started, kind of, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A thing happens here, a thing happens there, that before you know it, you have a certain kind of, something going, a certain ingredients. Tell me about some of the shows that you first worked with at Hanna-Barbera. How did you, what creative inputs did you
well,
have throughout?
I think the one of the very first, when I came on, we were all, Hanna-Barbera was already involved in Yogi Bear and Huckleberry Hound. I just stepped in and made more of them. Yeah. Then we decided to come up with something else. And at the time, I'll be very honest, at the time the Honeymooners were very popular. We thought that was an excellent idea and maybe we should do something like that. But what can we do that was different? And Joe Barbera, myself, and another fellow who's not even with us anymore, sat around kicking around ideas, and we thought about putting them back in the Stone Age. And the whole gimmick there was designing the Stone Age gimmicks, the cars and the homes and the vacuum cleaners and so on and so forth.
I understand that you tried to go somewhere in time, and you
yes.
were actually in Roman period.
Yeah,
were,
we tried all these things, and
suddenly,
we even and thought about projecting them in the future, which we did in the subsequent series. But we just stumbled on the Stone Age thing, and it just seemed to be perfect. It just worked out perfect, and we were right. It did become very, very popular. Coming up with new ideas like that.
Did you direct those or anything?
Yes, I directed all of those.
All
just about all of them, yeah. Produced and directed all of them, boarded them, and helped.
Now that show
the
came on in the evening.
Yeah, that was a nighttime
nice
show.
Segment of
7 o'clock. So-called Family Hour.
See, now I was just old enough to really appreciate
yeah.
that show, and I couldn't miss it. Yeah.
And see, that had that magic quality about it that kids loved it, and so did adults.
Oh yeah, sure.
And
it was almost similar to the Bullwinkle kind
yeah.
of pull.
And. It's hard to get that kind of a show going. We tried several after that, these so-called primetime 7 o'clock Family Hour shows. And we, the only other one that approached it, I think, was the Jetsons. We went the other extreme. We decided, well, we're in the Stone Age now, let's go on way out.
Yes.
And they were kind of successful, of course.
And you directed those as well?
I did those too, yeah. Just about all of them, yeah. I think all of them, actually. And
now, how many Jetsons were there and how many Flintstones were there? I mean,
God, I think we must have, I think like we did around 36 Flintstones a year.
Okay. It seemed like that many.
Yeah, we did. Like, in those days, the networks would buy a half a year.
Of course, it would come on then once a week.
Once a week, yes, for 36 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we did 36 of those a year for, I don't know, 7 years or so. And then we, so that's a lot of Flintstones, well over 100 and some odd. Jetsons, I think, ran out two or three.
Is Alan Reed the pastor?
Alan passed away a
now,
few
tell
years
me,
ago.
When that happened, Did you already have another Fred Flintstone in mind? Or
we had.
Did you consider at that time? Well, gosh, maybe
no.
you lost it or.
No. We always find that we can find somebody to step in. Now we found a gentleman, Alan. As he grew ill, we had to do things, and we found somebody that can come fairly close to Alan. In all I must admit, nobody can do Alan like he did, but we got a gentleman that does a fine job. The kids never know the difference, so forth.
It doesn't sound like he distorted his voice that much. I guess he pretty much sounded
like
Fred.
No, he just was himself, yeah.
Regular.
Right. He was just himself with the little theatrical.
Was he somewhat
blustering.
Like the character of Fred?
Very much like him. He even designed the character. He looked like Fred for some reason.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we sort
yeah,
of combined
about
that.
Because that does.
Paulie gentleman, and we sort of combined some of his little idiosyncrasies and
features. Almost similar to what you did with
Dawes.
To
what we were doing, yeah.
That's interesting.
So,
I really like that character. Yeah. So it must have been sad to see Alan.
Oh, yes. We all felt very badly about that.
Do you remember what the last Alan Reed recording session? Do you remember?
I'm trying to remember what was the last one.
Did you ever know it was the last recording session?
No, of course not. I didn't realize. I knew we weren't going to make any more. This was the last of the series at the time. Then we weren't going to make any for next year. And then along the line, we started to make. We knew it was ill, yeah.
That this may be one of the last ones.
No, I didn't think of that. I knew he. I guess
yeah.
I didn't want to
yeah,
think
you've
that
been with
way.
Him for
I
so
just
many years, it's hard
put
to
it out of my mind. I just
yes.
assumed that will go on forever.
Yes.
I'd rather feel that way.
Yes.
Anyway, you know. So I never thought that. Gosh, I'm going to lose Alan. I never thought of that.
What was his problem now?
I don't know the technical name of it, but it had something to do with cancer of the prostates or something like that. And it's not nice, whatever it was. I wouldn't tell the kids, but it was some kind of prostate.
Do you have a family?
Cancer.
Are you married?
I'm divorced now. I have two children, two girls, both of them grown
teenagers
up. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I have four grandchildren, little tiny ones, but nevertheless, four grandchildren.
Did you get some of your ideas or some of your input to the cartoons? Did your kids ever say to you, gee, Dad, why don't you have in the Land of Bedrock, why don't you put this guy who...
Yes, I have exactly that thing. My youngest daughter, Tina, must have been about 8 years old at the time and very... involved in Flintstones, and she wrote out a little plot. Believe it or not, I brought it in and showed it to Joe.
Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.